Hi, my name is Anne McElhenney.
And I'm Phelan McAleer.
Welcome to the Anne Phelan Scoop.
What's on? It's
week 58, Phelan. It's week 58, which is 1 year, 1 month and 2 weeks since the 2 weeks to flatten the curve lockdown.
So 58 weeks later of the 2 weeks. Yeah, okay. And what's happening, Anne? Have we flattened the curve yet?
So just a couple of funny things I saw, you know, or annoying things I saw. So I saw this. Look at this photograph from the New York Times and look at the headline that goes with it. Michigan's COVID wards are filling up with younger patients,
yes.
Right? So you know what you picture in your mind. And then this is the picture that goes with it.
Yes.
James Dyer, 55.
Yes.
You know, by the way, can I just say, as a person of a certain age,
yes,
that I respect the New York Times for calling me younger, a younger person.
Yes.
I like that, younger, yes, person. I would have to say, though, I think in the style book of the New York Times, I don't think I qualify as a younger person.
Yes, and another thing I want to say is Mr. Dyer, his situation doesn't look that dire. Get it?
Why do you say that?
Well,
as a medical expert now, I think I should...
Well, first of all, there's a cameraman in the room with him. Second of all, he...
He's not wearing a mask.
He's not wearing... You know, he's not being intubated, which is a word nobody knew about before this pandemic, but now everybody knows he's not intubated.
Oh, and they say he's recovering, by the way.
Recovering, so... Mr. Dyer, ain't that dire?
Well, I think the only thing I want to call attention to is Mr. Dyer's age, because I think if you're going to make a headline which is trying to terrify the people...
Younger people.
About younger people, you know, in my head I get like, you know, I immediately think of a 14-year-old.
Or
yeah?
a 22-year-old.
Or even a 22-year-old, that's right, yeah.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
55,
and
not
by the
sure.
way, in a newspaper obsessed with race too, we should point out that Mr. Dyer appears to be African-American, appears
correct,
to be black.
And?
Which, who are more vulnerable, I believe.
Disproportionately.
Disproportionately vulnerable. To the COVID virus, Chinese COVID virus.
And what's
virus.
Your point that they should say younger and person of colour?
Well, they always said people of colour were more vulnerable. I don't even know if that's true or not, but this was the big thing. Oh, you know, it's particularly... So, I mean, so he's not an example of a new wave or a new situation.
It's more of the same.
More of the same.
So then we have from... And, you know, I have to say, this is what I do when I can't sleep at night. I look at headlines in the Daily Mail. And you know what's sad is that some of the biggest stories in this pandemic have actually been covered by the Daily Mail. And here's a story that's not getting any kind of attention at all. Literally getting very little attention. Fully open Texas and Florida are reporting fewer new cases per capita than Michigan, Pennsylvania and New York, where mask mandates and other COVID restrictions are still in place. And a couple of photographs there. So basically the big takeaway from this is Texas's statewide mask mandate ended on May the 9th.
March 9th.
March the 9th.
And
President Biden called it...
Neanderthal thinking.
Neanderthal thinking. A little judgy there, by the way.
Yes.
But, you know, maybe he was right.
This is a healing president.
But he's a healing president.
He's bringing the country together.
He's bringing the
people,
you know.
People from Texas are Neanderthal.
So those Neanderthals, guess what happens now after March the 9th? So six weeks later, after the mask mandate was lifted, there has yet to be an explosion of COVID-19 cases. It's something Dr. Anthony Fauci can't quite explain. I'm... not really quite sure, he told MSNBC this week. It could be that they're doing things outdoors.
Yes.
Oh, that could be a good reason not to lock people down then. Maybe you should let them out. Maybe we should let the whole world out. Maybe being outdoors is a great idea. Data from the US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show that the 7-day moving average number of cases in Texas dropped to its lowest level since mid-June. According to the CDC,
wow.
Texas was averaging whatever the numbers are there. Mississippi also removed its COVID-19 restrictions around the same time.
And it saw a drop in virus cases and hospitalizations. This world has gone nuts.
The world has gone nuts because, you know, and we say this very, very often on this program and also when we were doing the Daily Virus. There are actually major news stories that should be covered, like the fact that everyone's out and about in Florida and
in
they're
Texas.
Not dropping dead.
Yeah, Ireland is completely locked down. Britain is completely locked down. And they're not sending reporters over to Florida and Texas and
to
saying,
say, wow, what's happening here?
Could we replicate this?
Yeah, no. And you know, obviously there's something about being outdoors and of course they're not letting people outdoors. Just horrible. Anyway, that was kind of an interesting opening to our quite... busy podcast today, Phelan. So what else is happening?
The Oscars were at the weekend.
We watched, so you didn't have to.
Yeah, well, I know you've probably forgotten about it now. And we're sorry to bring up such a traumatic experience. But we'll talk about it, but not for long, hopefully, because I really just don't want to give the energy.
And later we'll interview our dear friend, Chuck Donovan, who's the president of the Charlotte Lozier Institute, about Planned Parenthood's half-hearted acknowledgement of their esteemed leaders' eugenic beliefs.
And UK stands up to China. No, it doesn't actually. It just shows, actually that hostages often try and please their captors.
And remember Hunter Biden's memoir? Well, we've discovered he's getting a very helpful advantage from Amazon. We're going to share that with you.
Well, these tech billionaires stick together, and Democrats. So, and we interview Maria in a very sad story, actually. Maria, a mother who's become the heartbreaking victim of the transgender movement, the transgender social contagion that is destroying her autistic, socially awkward son.
And crazy California is just getting crazier.
Yeah, we could just, that's just a headline we could have every week.
Yeah. You right? Just have to say that, exactly. Yeah. No matter, you don't want to change it at all.
And Anne McElhinney.
Hello.
Anne McElhinney.
Hello.
Has had her stand-up comedy debut.
Hello.
And she kills it. We'll be playing a little clip from that.
And I just want to say, in case I forget to say it later on, we might play it quite late, actually, so that people don't have to watch it, because there might be some language warning.
Well, then we can give people warnings. We can give people trigger warnings.
We can trigger. Yeah, we can trigger your warning triggers. Yes. In advance. Okay.
And remember Anne's pen pal story from last week? We have a beautiful comment from one of our listeners up in Canada, so you won't want to miss that. And what's the recipe today, Anne?
And easy peasy, very easy peasy crispy potato wedges.
Does that mean there's peas in it?
Easy peasy. No, easy peasy.
All right.
Just easy peasy, but there's no peas. But Phelan would love peas, because Phelan really likes peas, because he's got a whole thing about peas. It's quite sad,
peas,
really.
Easy peasy is etymologically...
No. Phelan, tell us about the Oscars.
Oscars. I mean, first thing that struck me was, where's the movies? No clips. No clips at all. You get to hear somebody used to sell popcorn in a movie house. So, you know, some director, what was your first job in the movies? Oh, I used to sell popcorn. It's like, I don't care, but I do want to see your movie. It's a movie award show. And those intros were kind of like, you know the intros that they do in that TV show, Family Feud? And we're joined now by the Murphy family from Ohio, Cincinnati. And John is an accountant and Mary is a homekeeper. And their daughter is an engineer.
Fern
is an engineer. And tell us an interesting story, Marty, about you had a very interesting client. And
what happened to you last week,
yes,
in the car?
Yes, and then he tells a really bad story and they move on. That was what it was like. It was like, tell us about your interesting past working as a showrunner, as a script editor for somebody. And it's not that interesting. There was lots of politics.
It was incredibly woke. Both of the... So they had the before show. They had those kind of, the red carpet sort of before show thing. And both of the people asking the questions, both of the hosts, I suppose, of that, were African-American. And, you know, no problem at all. But it was like, it felt forced. It felt like, oh, God, we got to get some, you know, we got to make sure that everyone here is African-American. And there was definitely a very, very impressive and... very visual preponderance of African Americans in every part of the show,
yes, I have to say. Yes.
And then there was an incredible amount of political, of people making political speeches, with a couple of beautiful exceptions, like Tyler Perry, by the way. Big shout out to Tyler Perry, who made a really nice little comment, and we'll hopefully get a little clip of that. Because
yeah, he basically said he's not going to get involved in hate. And
I'm not going to hate the cops.
I refuse to hate someone because they are Mexican or because they are black or white or LGBTQ. I refuse to hate someone because they are a police officer. I refuse to hate someone because they are Asian. I would hope that we would refuse hate.
And he's not going to hit the cops especially. Interesting.
You know, very, very nice. I like that. I was happy with him. Also, interestingly enough, and I was surprised, was Dormant. What's her name?
Frances Dormant.
Who is the lead actress in the film Nomadland. Which was given, by the way, the best film award.
Again, politically.
I think it's good. I think it's really good. I really like it.
There's a lot of politics in it too.
She didn't say a word.
Yes.
She didn't say a word about politics, and I was really impressed with that. Everyone who didn't say anything about politics, I really liked.
But where were the movies? Like, why weren't they showing clips of the movies?
I think
they
showed microscopic clips filmed when you were out of the room. And
by the way,
it went on for 3 hours.
Yes, and like a bad movie had a really bad ending.
Yes.
When they thought Chadwick Boseman was going to win Best Actor, and his wife would give a... Our widow, sorry, would give a moving
speech. So instead of that, actually, Anthony Hopkins won.
An 83-year-old white man who won, who didn't even bother turning up. So it was a very unclimactic ending.
And by the way, interestingly enough, in the in the documentary category, the documentary that I reviewed recently on this podcast, My Octopus Teacher, which, by the way, I'll be very honest and confess to you, I went into watching it very, very cynical and ready to hate it. And you just can't hate it. You just can't.
I bet I can.
There's no politics in it. I couldn't find any.
I'm going to go in and hate it.
No, don't ruin it. It's actually really nice, and I would recommend people to show it to children, anyone. Like, it's lovely and it's relaxing. And that's the two movies I liked was My Octopus Teacher and Nomadland, which I felt were very, very, I don't know, kind of, there was something kind of pure about it and very nice to watch. I found it very, very easy to watch. Yeah. Okay.
So let's go and interview our friend, Chuck Donovan. He's the president of the Charlotte Lozier Institute.
And he's just written a really interesting Wall Street Journal piece.
Op-ed
that we want to focus on.
So let's go over to that interview now.
Well, thank you so much, Chuck Donovan, for joining us. We're very lucky to have Chuck Donovan, who's just joined us, who is the president of the Charlotte Lozier Institute. And I want to give the correct reason for the Charlotte Lozier Institute, whose goal is to promote a deeper understanding of the value of human life, motherhood and fatherhood, and to identify policies and practices that will protect life and serve both women's health and family well-being. He's also the co-author of Blessed Are the Barren, the Social Policy of Planned Parenthood, which he co-authored in 1991, just 30 years ago. And, you know, look at that, Chuck. It's suddenly become really relevant. Or Planned Parenthood have certainly suddenly discovered something that you discovered a really long time ago about their eugenic past. First of all, welcome to the show, Chuck.
Pleasure to be on with you both, and thanks for all you do for principle in public life. It's not all that common.
Well, thank you so much. I think it's probably best to start, because you wrote an amazing op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this past week about Planned Parenthood's efforts to distance themselves from Margaret Sanger's eugenic past. I think the best place for us to start here is to just give people a little brief history of eugenics. And what was eugenics look? What did it look like in America?
I think it's very difficult for people a century later to realize just how dominant a philosophy eugenics was. Obviously, back in the writings of Darwin, the science community first began to understand the role genes could play in all sorts of things, including hereditary characteristics and so forth. And lots of useful things have been learned as a result of that. But a lot of political ideas seeped into it, including various ideas about creating a master race, that being the most extreme. Others about breeding better human beings, that idea is still with us. And as a policy matter, it became an avenue to, I would say, elite academic credentials, or at least academic credentials among the elite. It was a pretty common belief that eugenics was one of the more reliable tickets to a better future for humankind, but it also attracted a lot of people who were poorly grounded in understanding of human rights, or I would call the American principle of equality under the law. It was not viewed that way. They viewed it as a tool to basically remake the people rather than the more conventional means of improving society.
You know, I mean, it's funny, I'm quite fascinated by eugenics, and it's a history. It's one of those histories that gets very scant attention for very obvious reasons, I think. But things like, I mean, I was surprised to realize that things like the Bonnie Baby competition, which I'm not sure they still have them, really came out of they used to have on fairgrounds, they'd have like, you know, the perfect family competition. And that basically was people who were sort of literally white supremacists, right? They were kind of like blonde and perfect and tall and all of that type of thing. And that got celebrated. And people who didn't come up to the mark were made very clear that they weren't, you know, pure.
And let's be clear, this was a progressive idea, not a conservative idea. So the idea of creating a master race was a progressive idea from the eugenics movement, not from the conservative movement.
It was not. And let me give you an example. Warren Harding, president in the first part of the 20s in the United States, gave an address on this topic in the White House papers. I don't play up such things, but he spoke to 100,000 people about the threat of inferior races to the future of the United States. So you could draw a mammoth crowd. Some of Margaret Sanger, we'll talk about her in a minute, I'm sure, but some of her closest confidants and co-writers in her birth control review staged events in Madison Square Garden, and they'd be teeming with devotees of this new science. It helped lead to the 1924 immigration bill, which put all sorts of clamps on immigration from Eastern Europe, from Russia and other countries where the common sense was these were intellectually and physically inferior people, more given to mental illness and the like. And the goal of the movement was to shut that down and to sterilize if they had to, if they couldn't prevent immigration.
So, you know, bringing us forward to your article, I mean, by the way, we could talk for a very long time about eugenics, but what was Margaret? So Margaret Sanger is celebrated as the founder of Planned Parenthood, but she has a very, very close connection with this very disturbing eugenics movement that Planned Parenthood are now trying to disavow. First of all, let's just get a sense of how involved she was with this movement, with this thinking.
Well, I would place it among her two or three primary motivations. Her belief in eugenics got to the point where her journal, Birth Control Review, which she edited for more than a decade, bore on its masthead the slogan, "Birth Control to Build a Race of Thoroughbreds." And she published the likes of Ernst Rudin from Germany, who was an advocate for the eugenical courts in that country in the 30s and 40s. Harry Laughlin, who was one of the most prominent eugenicists in the United States. A gentleman named Lothrop Stoddard, one of whose books was titled The Rising Tide of White Supremacy The Rising Tide of Race Against White World Supremacy. And the premise of his book was basically that the United States, again, had every duty, as he called it, to shut down immigration from foreign countries, much as you would shut down a bacteria invading the body. So they didn't mask words, and almost all of them, including six other members of the American Eugenics Society, were on Margaret Sanger's board at the Birth Control Federation of America.
So you've obviously been talking about this for decades, yes. And again, many people have been talking about it. I suppose Planned Parenthood has embraced those criticisms over these decades and welcomed them, have they?
They've treated it as sort of she was a bit of an outlaw, outre, whatever you would want to call it. Faye Waddleton, who was president of Planned Parenthood in the early 70s, I believe, and into the 80s, referred to Margaret Sanger's outrageous behavior. So as if she was basically, I don't know, just a very interesting type. Well, she had a lot of things about her that were interesting. She abandoned her own children and went overseas and made friends with people she thought could advance her career. But she was a lot more than that, and she adapted her policies and her proposals. And that as much as the controversy over the ethics of birth control really drove her opposition. Planned Parenthood does not like to admit that.
Yeah, but they've been they've kind of demonized people like yourself who've been trying to point that out for decades. Isn't that right?
I think it's fair. I think there have been one or two things that have been written about her by conservatives that I think the record doesn't completely support or you need nuances about. With respect to racism, I think she was very content that there would be reduction in births among Blacks. But I think her main focus was the elimination of what she called human weeds, the unfit. Yeah. And she really didn't care what race or background or nationality was involved. Yeah. The people around her were definitely of a racial mindset, and she was very comfortable with them. She never rejected that. Even went off to speak to the Ku Klux Klan at Silver Lake, New Jersey, when she got an invitation there. Unfortunately, we don't have her speech. I wish we did.
Oh, that's a shame. But we do have her 1934, the baby code, which you quoted in the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, I read that and it's like, you know, more people should know that, you know, this was not an off the cuff like remark. This is something that was a studied, thought through idea that she thought you know, that people, you know, if, that it wasn't enough that people would get a license to get married. People should have a license to have babies. And some people shouldn't be given that license at all. Could you tell us a little bit more about the 1934 baby code that Margaret Sanger came up with?
Well, she came up with an original version called the Plan for Peace. And this was her way of guaranteeing peace. But she published the baby code in 1934. And among its provisions was, as you mentioned, having to get a license to marry from the state, which of course still happens. But the question there was whether certain people would ever get a license based on these qualities of IQ. She believed in applying Stanford-Binet even to get that license. And then you'd have to get a separate license to have each child. And she goes on to say that immigration should be eliminated, which pretty much happened by then with the 1924 statute sharply reduced. But the quote was that she thought that a rigid code of sterilization and segregation should occur to various groups, among whom she listed the feeble-minded, which by some calculations was half the public, anyone with epilepsy, anyone with an inheritable disease. And of course, the understanding of what diseases were inheritable wasn't exactly robust. Anyone of lower intelligence, just really brutal stuff. But her belief was they could have a choice to be sterilized where they were or go to a segregated camp and live out their lives there.
Gosh, amazing. But I mean, of course, we've all, you know, moved on. That was 1934. You know, these are times past. Everything's got better now. Planned Parenthood is much better now. They've nothing to do with that eugenic past, right? You say in your op-ed, deeds matter more than words. Planned Parenthood can begin to redress its past by ending its current embrace of eugenic abortion. So you talk about they still have eugenic abortion. Can you tell us what that means?
Well, they are lead plaintiffs against statutes that have now been enacted in about 7 or 8 states, including 2 cases that are on the verge of getting to the Supreme Court. Most prominently, Ohio, where the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, about 2 weeks ago, I believe, upheld an Ohio law banning abortions for disability. Nearly every state in the country has been allowing abortions performed because the baby's been found to have or suspected of having even a Down syndrome. And who has been the lead litigators in these cases? Planned Parenthood was the lead litigator in Indiana, lead plaintiff. Same thing in Ohio. And this has begun to spark a really strong reaction from the members of the Sixth Circuit, previously members of the Seventh Circuit, in a minority, and then Judge Clarence Thomas, who in his opinion in the Indiana case, wrote a long historical piece about Sanger and eugenics and made the point that he does not think the court has addressed this issue, even in the context of Roe v. Wade. Yeah. So that's the reason for this call for Planned Parenthood to change course. If they drop their opposition to these statutes, I think there's a good chance the court could say, new understanding, 40 years ago, kids with Down syndrome were kept in isolated hospitals. Correct. Average age of death was under 10. Now it's 60 because we're doing the caring, not the killing.
Wow.
Yeah, and as you say, and it's not just Down syndrome, it's a whole list. I mean, I was quite surprised. I'm sure you've seen the extraordinary BBC documentary. The End of Downs, I think, where they basically... Yeah. We're telling the story of Iceland, which has cured Down syndrome by having 100% abortions of people who are diagnosed as having been pregnant with a Down's child.
Yeah, the documentary is very sad and compelling. Iceland has approached this point. Denmark, we probably lose 60-70% of children with Down syndrome in the United States, and think about how profound. Besides the moral question involved, or the human rights and equality question, think about the scientific ignorance. What does it mean to come out and say you've cured something by eliminating the people who have it? Apply that to cancer or anything? We can get that all done.
Yes.
And in a way, this has been Planned Parenthood's worst message is, we're going to have a race of thoroughbreds, and if you don't qualify, look out.
Yeah,
it's a camp or the graveyard.
Well, they used to. They used to talk, I mean, remember, you know, the big thing in America and Vietnam, you had to destroy the village to save the village. You know, this is very, very similar. And they're also, I mean, it's not just Down syndrome, cleft palate.
I was going to say, yeah, cleft palate, hair lip. In the UK, I think our memory of that from the documentary was that that qualifies you, that if you're pregnant with a child with a cleft lip or a hair lip, that it qualifies at any stage for an abortion. And we have some we know some people with both, and they are, you know, extremely bright and extremely intelligent. Not that that even matters, by the way, but it's an amazing that eugenic principle on which Planned Parenthood was built and the abortion movement was built on. They're not divorced from that at all.
Well, that's how I'd say it. You know, it is not discussed as often. It needs to be discussed more, but as it practiced, we now have a science that can practice this without saying much about it. And Planned Parenthood is protecting laws permitted.
Yeah. And by the way, even their distancing themselves from the name Margaret Sanger because of this eugenic past, they're not even really doing that very robustly, no. Right? I think it's like one building in New York, am I right? It's not like all over the country, is that right?
Yeah, and look, it hasn't been going on very long. When Bob Marshall and I published our book about a decade later, and it takes a while to write a book, we did this in our spare time, but Ellen Chesler wrote a biography of Sanger that actually hadn't been a new one in a long time. It was called A Woman of Valor. Found nothing but praise for her. And, you know, Bob and I raised a whole host of issues, including the abortion issue, eugenics, the Planned Parenthood's very odd sexual libertinism, which is not a good way to plan a family, to be frank. But we raised a bundle of issues, but they gave not an inch to us. And they more or less pretended the book didn't exist. And Woman of Valor, that book, was a response to it. It just didn't find the things we found everywhere about her background.
Yeah.
It's interesting, but I really appreciate it. I really appreciate that you wrote that op-ed, because I think I really think it is a really hidden history. The whole eugenics story is a very much a hidden story. And when you tell people it, when you find out more about it, we've been kind of digging into it a little bit and looking at archive footage from back in the day. It's incredible. And that there was a world fair, I think, was it in New York or in Washington? And they had these exhibits, you know, and they had all that stuff about the imbeciles and the, you know, and they had all those different names for people. It's incredible. And no one, you know, most kids don't know about this.
It was the scientific consensus.
Yeah. That's another sign. That's not another reason not to like scientific consensus. We've come to the end of this interview, but we want to ask all our guests. We ask our guests two additional questions. And I sent them to Chuck earlier, and I'm not sure he was happy, but, you know, let's see. And Chuck, by the way, I should have said in our introduction, is a friend. So, Chuck, have you been cooking a lot during the pandemic? And if you cook, what do you cook?
Well, I do cook a lot when it's grilling. So I can grill anything, probably not as well as the people of Texas. But I'm artful at that. But my main thing is making a brunch. I am the brunch maker in the family household. Mm-hmm. I make waffles, omelets, eggs benedict, you name it. If it's breakfast on Sunday, my wife will let me in the kitchen, and I bring out some pretty good meals for the kids.
One of these days we're going to get together and I will make the frittata for the Donovan household, because I'm quite famous for my frittata.
Well, do you have a recipe, Chuck, of anything, or do you
I use a joy of cooking with a little bit of tweak. I will use obviously fresh fruit. Sometimes make a little whipped cream to go on top of that if I want to go really over the top. But joy of cooking is pretty good, especially the older editions. I imagine the new ones are probably politically correct.
Oh, yeah, of course. And we asked you if you had a piece of art that you'd want to share that's important to you, that you love.
Yes, I love music. I play a little bit of keyboard, but it's not a keyboard piece. Our good friend Ravel's string quartet, I think he wrote only one. It's absolutely gorgeous, and I like the version by the Guarneri Quartet. They play it a little differently.
Okay, we're gonna add that to the show notes so people can listen to that.
Very good. Well, Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time this morning. Always a pleasure. And I think we'll talk to you again about this, because I think this is going to be a niggling issue for Planned Parenthood to deal with going forward. Particularly the fact, you know, that they, this eugenics path that they are trying to distance themselves from, but really aren't taking it that seriously.
Okay, Chuck, thank you.
It'll be a pleasure. Thank you.
All the best. Bye.
Well, I want to have Chuck back on again.
Yes.
And can I just say, let's just do this one thing here at the end of his interview. Let's just watch the trailer right now of the BBC documentary, A World Without Down Syndrome. You can watch this, by the way, the whole thing. It's on YouTube for free.
Yeah.
I cannot recommend this documentary more. I think it's the best documentary I've ever seen. If that's not a good enough recommendation for you, I don't know what is.
So,
it's absolutely fabulous. It's the narrator of the documentary, by the way, is the woman who played Bridget Jones's sidekick in Bridget Jones's Diary, and she has her own child is Downs, and she's perfect.
Let's hear that now.
Chicken who?
Buck, buck.
What? That's rubbish.
Knock, knock.
Who's that?
85.
85 who?
Doctor!
This is Ollie, my son. He likes chocolate ice cream. He likes Barcelona Football Club. He also has Down syndrome. When Ollie was diagnosed 11 years ago, I never could have imagined that our family was going to end up looking like this. Or like this. Or like this. But although Ollie's the reason I started making this film, it's not just a film about him. It's not just about Down syndrome either. It's a film that asks the question, what kind of society do we want to live in? And who do we think should be allowed to live in it?
Okay, well,
that's great.
Don't forget to watch that. It's available on YouTube.
Talking of the UK film.
Yes, this is just a little point. So the UK has reduced its aid to China by 95%. It used to give £100 million to China, and now it's giving £5 million to China. And it's like,
what?
China is one of the world's biggest.
What is going on?
China is one of the world's biggest economies. China has destroyed everybody else's economy by letting people travel from Wuhan around the world, but not letting people from Wuhan travel around China.
What is wrong with people? What is the UK doing giving charity to China? I don't even understand that. I mean, the UK have a lot of their own problems, by the way.
Yes.
And China is really wealthy.
Yes.
God, it's pure madness.
I bet it's gender empowerment in Yangjing or something like that. Or, you know.
I wish every government in the world was required to have some kind of ticker tape running somewhere in at all public buildings showing taxpayers' money and how it's been spent.
Yeah.
Particularly this money that goes out of the country while people within the country have real needs that are not being met. It's extraordinary. This is a very short little story. I had to mention this, by the way. So I have discovered that Amazon are
giving an assist
to Hunter Biden's book. So, as you know, I read Hunter Biden. I bought
Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, who we are making a movie about. My son Hunter. Please go to mysonhunter.com.
Give what you can. So basically, I decided to read the Hunter Biden memoir. It's called Beautiful Things, very, you know, chronicling his addiction and all of that. Anyway, I read the book and I wrote a review. I said, this is a terrible book. The most crucial and central awfulness is that in a confessional memoir, Hunter Biden and his publishers deny the existence of his fourth daughter. She is written out of history by him and his father, the US president, a self-described progressive. The publisher lied completely, unnecessarily, and cruelly in their bio. They name his other children.
But not...
Imagine doing this to a child. You don't have to imagine. Hunter and Joe Biden did that to a child. This is awful and always. I wrote. And I also, helpfully, you're allowed to put in an image as well. In my image that I added, you'll see I added the image of the bio showing
from
where
the
they
book.
Named
yeah.
from the book.
And you gave it a 1-star.
And I gave it a 1-star. And then they let me know immediately, you know, that they had to review it and that within a few days it would be published or whatever. So then I get this email a number of days later. Thank you for submitting a customer review. After carefully reviewing your submission, your review could not be posted to the website. While we appreciate your time and comments, reviews must adhere to the following guidelines. So I would ask my very intelligent and clever and beautiful and attractive, wonderful listeners and watchers to help me out and help me work out what I did wrong. So the review should focus on specific features of the product. Mm-hmm. I did that, right?
You did that.
And your experience with it. I definitely did that. Feedback on the seller or your shipment experience. Mm-hmm. I had nothing to say about that. We do not allow profane or obscene content. I did not do that. Yeah. This applies to adult products too.
No.
No problem. Didn't do it. Advertisements, promotional material, or repeated posts that make the same point excessively are considered spam.
Not guilty.
I didn't do it. Not guilty. Next, please do not include URLs external to Amazon or personally identifiable content in your review.
I didn't do that.
And any attempt to manipulate community content or features, including contributing false, misleading, or inauthentic content, is strictly prohibited. So I didn't break any of those rules. So if anyone's got any suggestions about what I can do next, I suppose I should phone them. Is there a telephone number there?
No.
Perhaps I should phone them. Maybe I'm going to phone them next.
Amazon.
Oh, I suppose they don't have any humans there.
Oh, you can't phone Amazon.
You can't phone Amazon.
But they do have humans, but they're just humans that don't answer to whippersnappers like you.
So what I did was I went on Amazon and looked up to see what was happening. So basically people have written very negative, you know, a number of people have written very negative reviews, quite a number of them actually, saying the point, making a point similar to the point I'm making about the child that has been written out of history by the President of the United States and his son. A horrible, horrible thing to do. Forget about politics. And I just think what has happened is that Amazon has decided, well, let's not have too many of those now.
Yes.
But I paid for the book on Amazon.
The book.
I bought the book on
Kindle. And by the way, Amazon can check that too.
No, it's all there.
It's all there. That, you know,
they know I'm a verified.
And even a thing comes up saying this person has bought the product.
They know I'm a verified reader, and it's So I will keep you posted on my
developments. So now we go to a sad story, and we're going to go and interview Maria, not her real name, to hear about the true victims of the transgender craze, the transgender cult and its promoters. So let's go over that interview that we did earlier.
We're joined now by Maria, and that's not her real name. And she's asked that we disguise her identity. And Maria wants to talk about her son, Tom. And again, that's not his real name.
And when you hear this story, you'll understand why Maria wants to keep her identity secret.
Yeah. It's a very delicate story, but it's a very important story. And you know, don't think that you're immune from this story, and it can't happen to you, because it can happen to anyone. There are very insidious forces out there. So let's go over now and talk to Maria. Welcome to the show, Maria.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
So thank you for coming on. So you're in we'll just say you're on the East Coast. You have a normal family life, nothing, you're not involved in radical politics or even moderate politics. You just live your life and have a family, correct?
Correct. Husband, wife, children, you know, two-parent family, stable, professional.
Yeah. But you have a son called Tom, and we'll call him Tom for here. And Tom, I believe it was always slightly autistic, but is that what you would say? Describe.
Well, he wasn't slightly autistic. He was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome back when it was differentiated between Asperger's and autism. So when he was 7, he was diagnosed with Asperger's. So we've known all along that, you know, he had the syndrome. He had early interventions and therapies and special accommodations in school, but very, very bright. Mm-hmm. So yes.
And how did the Asperger's manifest itself? You know, was how did he behave in social situations, and how did you notice?
Yeah, he was always awkward socially. When he was younger, when he was very young, I would say toddler through possibly 6th grade, 12 years old, he was on the hyperactive side of things. He would just barge into people's, if there were like a group of children, he would just barge in without taking consideration that, you know, that was unacceptable. poke people, like he liked a girl, you know, just kind of poke her with a pencil to get her attention, and you know, just didn't know how to interact. As he got older, once he started hitting pre-puberty, he became the opposite, kind of withdrawn and, you know, just very uncomfortable in group social situations. He always had at least one friend or two, but in group settings, he didn't do well. And he always had, you know, trouble not blurting out in class or interrupting the teacher or getting fixated on a topic and talking about that endlessly.
Okay, so tell us about Tom's experiences at high school. I believe they're relatively positive.
Yes, he was in a special high school that was for engineering and computer science. And so he found a lot of like-minded young boys with whom he connected. He had a group of about five friends and they were like soulmates, did everything together like a pack. And when he got to senior year, he became terrified of the idea of leaving high school, did not want to go to college. I mean, he literally went into a deep depression about it. And so we gave him the option. We said, listen, you don't have to go to college. I mean, he was very bright and had won awards and prizes, competitions in the technical field. But they said, you don't have to go to a four-year college. You don't have to, you know, you can take a gap year, but you have to work. You can't sit playing video games for a year.
Yeah.
So he chose to go to college. And he went to college. He was probably between 18 and 19 when he met a couple of girls who were taking a gender study class. Mm-hmm. And they befriend him. And next thing we know, he's letting his hair grow and he's wearing all these rainbow buttons in his lanyard. And, you know, he was just acting very different than the way he would act before. He was stereotypically boy, you know, the nerdy boy. Mm-hmm. But he also was very interested in weightlifting and he's built like a, you know, linebacker. I mean, big kid. And so I asked him, you know, if he was gay, and he was offended that I would ask him such a thing. How dare I think that about him? Mm. In 2019, he came out to me and he told me that he had gender dysphoria and that he felt like he was a woman in a man's body. The first thing I asked was how, I mean, it wasn't a shock, but I didn't really understand what that meant exactly. Mm. To me, the idea of, you know, I guess I didn't even think I hadn't really heard the word transgender as much. It was more like transsexuals, transvestites. You know, to me, it was like, okay, what does this mean exactly? He's just confused. And he said, well, I said, what are your plans for the future? He said, well, if I could push a button right now and turn into a woman, I would, but I'm very scared. This is super scary to me and I'm nervous about it and it's so new. And so I asked him if he would go to counseling and he said, yes. So I talked to like three counselors and I vetted the counselor that was going to talk to him, and he was non-affirming. And, you know, saw this as a mental illness, you know, and also social contagion,
yes.
You know, peer influence. And, but he told us, the counselor told us that his goal was to just keep him safe. This was a phase that he was going through. He didn't know how long the phase was going to start, but he said the danger is that we just need to make sure that he doesn't start taking hormones and medicalizing. So his goal was just to kind of push the button, and he's kept talking to him about wait until you graduate college, wait until you are a full grown adult, you know, with your own insurance, with your own, you know, basically just hold off.
Yeah. So when you say non-affirming and that it's a social contagion, explain what social contagion means in this.
Yeah. Social contagion means that, when kids, particularly young people, are in an environment where they're influenced by their peers. You know, they was just like, they were all dressing one way or, you know, acting one way. They, even androgyny was a thing, you know,
that's
like
right.
in the 90s.
Correct.
But, you know, then people got over it. I mean, after a while, that stopped becoming a fad and they moved on with their lives. What makes this so different now is that these kids who are being, you know, infected, you know, quotations, by this social contagion virus are now being medicalized. So what would have been for upwards of maybe 90% of them a fad, all of a sudden now becomes, you know, a lifelong issue.
Yes, and affirmed by the medical establishment. And I think this is something people don't think about. You know, when I was that age, I mean, anorexia was big with young women. Cutting, I missed the cutting thing, but that came later. But these are all examples of mental illnesses or social contagions that the difference back then was all the medical establishment was united in, we got to stop anorexia, we got to treat it,
right.
we got to stop cutting. But now there's a significant part of the medical establishment that says these people who say they are born in the wrong sex, we need to listen to them and medicalize them and change their lives and change their bodies irrevocably.
Yes, that's what is so shocking and sad and incomprehensible.
Yeah.
And so do you feel like that when he was at school, when he's at high school, this was not part of anything he considered, like when he was going through puberty or any of that?
He was always uncomfortable in his skin. Yeah.
Yes. And in fact, at the very beginning of when he started therapy, after a few sessions, we met with his counselor, my son and the counselor. And my son said, I always felt uncomfortable in my body. And I was pushing him a little bit and saying, but was it about you being a boy? Or he was like, no, it was just like, it felt like I didn't fit within my body, like my arms, like my legs, like they didn't belong to my body, like almost like my head didn't belong with my body. I mean, it was like almost like a disconnect, like a dissociation between like his body. And I said, but that's part of autism. I said, that's part of how people with autism feel. They feel uncomfortable in their body, in their skin. They feel like they don't fit. No, 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 no. And then he said, so I went searching on the internet and I found this and all of a sudden it made sense to me.
Yeah.
And he said, I tried to be the guy who gets the girl and I wish that I could be the guy who walks away with a girl on his arm, and I've tried and that didn't work. So this is the only thing that makes sense. This just fits. It makes sense. So he basically, like so many of these young boys, diagnosed himself by probably some test or something he read on the internet.
Yeah. So the counselor was trying to help him see that, but then he took matters into his own hands then. Isn't that correct?
He was doing some do-it-yourself treatments at home. You know, I mean, I don't even know what that was about, but we would just see strange things that he was doing with, you know, things that he probably read on the internet. We heard that, we don't have confirmation of this, but we heard that he might have ordered some hormones from China that he used for a short time. We know that all through this, our counselor was adamant that he should not do any of these things. And we also got word that he was looking to get hormones. When he had been in counseling for maybe like 8 months or 9 months, that he started seriously pursuing that, and the counselor kept trying to stop him. And the counselor was kind of naive, like a lot of counselors are. They either seem to be affirming.
So this started in 2019. We're now in 2021.
He got coached on the internet and was given the name of a doctor out of state, in a neighboring state, an OBGYN, who on the first visit, He came out with some sublingual drops that she gave him and with a prescription for a testosterone blocker and for estrogen. Now, this was before the blood results were even back.
Before and what, sorry?
Blood results were back.
The blood results, like the labs that she ordered were even back. And those labs only were for like testosterone and estrogen. She did not check for autoimmune markers, which runs in our family. She didn't check for a risk, any kind of risk. All she did was basically just check his baseline for his hormone levels. And then that prescription went through and he started on those hormones. So that's what he's doing right now.
And how has that affected him? And how has that affected your family life?
Well, it's affected us profoundly. I mean, for one thing, we told him that our home was a safe place and he could not medicalize. People who judge parents like us, who are non-affirming, who don't jump in this bandwagon to support our children transitioning, medicalizing, we are accused that this is about not wanting a trans child. Our son had his long hair and his twist eyebrows and his shaved body and, you know, all these things for a year and a half. And we were fine with him living in our home. But it was when he chose to medicalize against everyone's advice, against his counselor, against our advice, against all safety parameters that we said, well, you can't stay in our home and medicalize, continue. We asked him to put the pause button. Well, he finished school, he refused. So he's going to be moving out shortly because of that.
And there's no reasoning with him in the sense, you know, because of his, I suppose, because of his autism, but also he's now being reaffirmed by the internet and by this doctor who's has told him it's a medical issue.
Right. Yes. I mean, the diagnosis from this doctor is endocrine dysfunction. He does not have endocrine dysfunction, but that is his diagnosis from this doctor, because supposedly he's a woman in a man's body and his body is making the wrong hormones. So they have to fix that problem. I try to show him some of the research about the really bad side effects of hormones. Within 4 months, the gray matter in the brain starts diminishing. There are cardiovascular changes. There is thinning of the bones, all of these things. And he told me that that research didn't apply to him because he was born in the wrong gender and now he was fixing the problem with his hormones. So, I mean, they're so indoctrinated by the internet. It's like, it truly is a cult. Mm-hmm. It is a cult.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if the friend group that he had, the good friend group he had in high school,
He's dropped all of his friends from high school because he's rewritten the narrative. None of those friends, I mean, they all loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them were hateful or prejudiced or judgmental or anything like that about it. But none of them are supporting what he's doing. So therefore he's dropped it. He now has a glitter family on the internet.
A glitter family? What's mm-hmm. that?
Glitter family is like, you know, the trans family that embraces what they're doing and the real families and the real friends, you know, we're transphobic and we're haters and,
And toxic. Yeah. Of
toxic, yeah.
It's a horrible situation. I can't even imagine what you guys are going through as a family. It's very, very tough.
Yeah, it really feels like a death in a way. It feels like you're constantly in the process of burying your child, and that's what they want. So we're not doing that. You know, I mean, honestly, in a way, where our son is now with his mindset, he would be delighted if we buried him. He told me, why don't we bury Tom and have a funeral for him? And I was like, no. I mean, I actually burst into tears and he felt badly about it and apologized. But yeah, I mean, but it does feel like a death. I mean, just now I was cleaning a room and I found all of these cards, you know, from the kids to my husband and I, and, you know, all this, you know, in his boy handwriting and his name. And but he tells my husband, I'm not your son, I'm your daughter now. And, you know, don't call me son and don't dead name me. But we don't call him by his female name. And we don't, I mean, he has like a whole persona on the internet that's female. But we're in a fairly, we're not in an area that is really woke. Mm-hmm. That is really into this.
Yeah.
So the universities and the high schools and, you know, probably some areas like, you know, the hip areas downtown mm-hmm. are very like supportive. But, you know, suburbia and the places where we move and where he works and people are not embracing of this. They're not jumping on it. And honestly, it's going to be interesting once he's on his own to see how he handles that away from the bubble of our protection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wonder what his friends will do then on the internet. You're right. It is a kind of a social contagion. I mean, I remember, and I must check it out. Now there was an article in the New York Times many, many years ago about a group of young people in a town. And I can't remember where they all had the same illness. They were all struck by the same illness at the one time. Mm-hmm. And they all started shaking. And it turned out to be just a social contagion. There was no environmental mm-hmm. that
yeah.
once a few of them, and it was all children too who didn't have fathers who were difficult home backgrounds or had some kind of autism like that. Yeah. And this is just the same. And again, the difference then was people wanted to get to the bottom of it and wanted to mm-hmm. stop it, as opposed to wanting to embrace it and celebrate it as courageous. Right.
Well, I mean, let's be real. There's a lot of monetary gain in doing this. I mean, those hormones are very expensive mm-hmm. and it's, you stay on them long enough, your body stops producing them and you're medicalized for life. I mean, even with the young adults, I mean, that's a whole other story to be told, but yeah. So, I mean, there's reasons why this is happening. There's reasons why there's such a push for it.
Yeah. I mean, your case is slightly unusual. Your son was a little bit older, but then his autism would mean he's, you know, socially younger.
Emotionally. Yes. I mean, we put him at about 13 or 14 years emotionally and socially, and he's making this like really adult decisions.
Yeah. So what would you say to parents who think it can't happen to them and to parents who it is happening to?
Yes, it definitely can happen to anybody. I mean, we had controls, internet controls in our internet system that my husband is a computer guy. I mean, we checked those controls. Everything was so innocent. You know, the first thing is check your internet. I mean, don't assume that, you know, they're not watching or involved into whatever it is that you don't think they're involved in.
Yeah.
Most of these kids are going to Discord, and they're even in YouTube, they're watching a lot of these transition videos. There's other sites that I can't remember right now, but those are some of the main ones.
Discord and YouTube, yeah.
But also you're saying, I think, am I right in saying that the biggest damage almost was done when he went to college and met the two women who were doing the gender studies?
Yes, I think they were the ones who, you know, got him started on that. But the internet is what really, I would say, those two girls, they went away with the pandemic. So on their, you know, because they get bored, they go for the next person.
Yeah.
But it truly was the internet that hijacked him. And they have like hypnosis videos that they watch that become like, you know, they become like hypnotized. And it's very, very, this influence that just takes over their brain.
Yeah.
The other thing too is, know what it is that they're being told at their school.
Yeah.
I mean, ask questions and find out what are they being taught in school. I mean, when they have these pride days and these, you know, find out exactly find out what the board policy is?
Yeah, because schools are encouraging this now. They're accommodating, and you know they're affirming this. Yeah. And when the school affirms it, and it's the cool thing to do, people are going to do it.
Yeah, I think I think parents, before their children start in a high school or a middle school or kindergarten or elementary school, should almost have a contract with the school, a legally binding contract with the school, where it says what will and will not be taught, so that they have some kind of legal resource.
I agree.
Because the problem is you let these beautiful children with their pure minds into this environment with these grown-ups who have amazing power and
they wield it.
And they wield it. And they wield it, and they get to put in their favorite pet ideologies as an experiment almost. Very disturbing. We're so glad you were able to talk to us today.
And we'd love to come back and revisit this story. And
we really hope, by the way, that something good happens to you, that something changes.
Thank you.
That he doesn't, you know, take those ultimate steps that really are irreversible in terms of damage.
I think all of our viewers and listeners wish you all the best. And we're going to cover this story and other stories like it, because it's one of the biggest scandals of our time. It's been given the wrong attention. So thank you very much, Maria.
And we wish you well, and we wish Tom well and the rest of the family, and hope that.
Thank you. Thank you. We hope he wakes up sooner rather than later. Yes. That's our hope.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's a sad story. Now, that is a sad story.
It's a really sad story.
It's a warning to us all to fight back for the truth and common sense, and to make sure that, you know, to fight back against this targeting and destruction of the most vulnerable in our society. History will look back at this time as a kind of a madness upon.
It's like the end of the Roman Empire. Yeah, yeah. I mean, but people, I would say people who, you know, in the past, there was a sense in which you could send your little gorgeous child off to the school and think, well, that's great, you know, all the lovely teachers are there and, you know, just gorgeous things and reading lovely books and everything. You just can't have that sense of... you can't have that sense of safety anymore. That safety is completely removed now. And so if you're in a situation where you're forced to send a child to a public school or to a public institution, you need to really get really, really busy finding out what they're doing and what they're teaching, and do your very, very best to prevent the damage in advance. Phelim, California, what's happening?
Well, Gavin Newsom has announced that California is now going to be the first state to end oil extraction in the country. And he's going to phase out all oil extraction as part of a world-leading effort to achieve carbon neutrality. And he's going to ban fracking by 2024. All I've got to say about that is we were in Louisiana about a week ago or something like that. Petrol, was $2.45 a gallon.
Yeah, that was expensive
stuff. In Louisiana, I think people were complaining about it.
Yeah.
We drove past a gas station yesterday, and the most expensive gas there was $5.95. Heading towards $6. Like, what price is it going to be when you end oil extraction and when you're anti-fossil fuels to that mad extreme? Like, we're going to talk $10, $20?
The worst problem as well here is that Gavin Newsom doesn't understand energy. And, you know, we've had some really great energy experts on here, like Robert Bryce and our friend John Harpole. I mean, they think electricity is an energy source. You know, they do. People think that electricity is an energy source. Electricity is a conduit. It's a pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And what the energy has to be made somewhere. And the really funny thing is, we make always the point here, it's all the cars driving around, all these electric vehicles, they're powered by coal. In the main, they're powered by coal. And I'll tell you, if they're not powered by coal, they're certainly powered by fossil fuels. Anyway, this is an awful... And again, just to show you how awful and crazy California is, the reaction to this has been very muted. Because again, most Californians, I suppose a lot of Californians are stoned, right? And the ones who aren't stoned don't know where energy comes from and don't realize that they're going to have a problem. And, you know, you know the story that we brought to you about what happened in Texas. You know, that will be coming to a state near you, and particularly to this state of crazy California.
Yeah.
Talking of funny things, Phelim.
Yes.
Do you like my segue there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Anne McElhenney's stand-up.
Woohoo.
So Anne... was so the a group called the American Freedom Alliance.
Our friends at the American Freedom Alliance.
Yes, they decided to have that we all needed to laugh, and they were correct.
Yes.
And they had an event at a hotel here, and
they were trying to keep the numbers down. It was huge demand. They had it on a Monday and a Tuesday night.
Little super spreader event.
Little super spreader event. And there was a couple of professional comedians there.
Yes.
And there was Anne McElhinney.
Ta-da!
And by popular acclamation, Anne McElhinney was adjudged to be the most funny there. And there was comedians there who have been doing stand-up for 10 years,
what
15
can I
years,
say?
20 years. So let's play a little clip there, Anne.
And I do think we should put a little trigger warning there because there might be some language.
Might be.
Might be.
Shocking.
Shocking.
Another thing not to do, okay, is don't watch House Hunters if you live in California. If you live in California, don't watch House Hunters during the pandemic. Because life is hard enough, but the last thing you need to watch is a 12-year-old with her boyfriend who are about to get married living in frickin' Alabama, meeting the real estate agent, where the real estate agent says, "How much do you want to spend?" And they're saying, $180,000. And then, like, what do you need in the house? "Well, we need a formal dining room. We'd like an enclosed yard. I need an island in the kitchen, at least 4 bedrooms." And they get the house for $140,000. So, yeah, don't watch that.
Okay, well, if you want to watch the whole thing, it's on YouTube, and we will put the link.
Just be aware there may be some language.
There might be some language.
But yeah, all of it, it's all there, and please send it out to anyone you think might be interested.
Yes, exactly. And we got a really nice message this past week.
On YouTube.
So Sarah Joy.
McQuaid.
Who's up in Canada. Sarah Joy, lovely name, by the way, can I just say. And Sarah Joy wrote, and she was mostly very affected by...
Yeah. Well, she says, "Thank you guys so much for your podcast. I'm homeschooled and live in the middle of nowhere in Canada."
Phelan, by the way, Sarah Joy, Phelan was brought up in the middle of nowhere, so he knows all about the middle of nowhere.
Well, that's a matter of dispute, actually.
Well...
It's all relative. We live in a thing called the Broad Road, which was an hour from Belfast, where people who lived sides of mountains, my friends.
That's true.
You know?
That is true.
I still live inside.
Tell us more about Sarah Joy, Phil.
Sarah Joy. So she lives in the middle of nowhere, and you're my connection to what's happening. We are her connection to what's happening in the world. We're still pretty locked down here. And she says, "And I'm also 16 and I have several pen pals.
Go for it.
Writing letters is my favorite way to communicate." And that's in reference to your story last week about your pen pal from when you were 7.
Yes.
10.
Holly
Fitzpatrick. And then she reached out to you a few years ago, 40 years later, and you met up in Scottsdale.
Yes.
And there's the picture of the two of you.
Yes.
And you, by the way, none of you have changed a bit, and you're... And you're both conservative, so that...
Well, that was quite nice, actually. That's true.
Hello, Sarah. Sarah Joy, and thank you for writing.
And thanks a million. Keep writing and keep listening. And thank you for your nice review. We really appreciate it.
So, just to confirm that we're Irish, the recipe this week is potato wedges.
And it was kind of a bit of a hectic time for the last while because we have been traveling quite a bit. So there's no video on this one, but it's just some pictures because it's actually kind of simple.
Some photographs.
So here's the trick with this. And as I said, I think I've mentioned this a few times in the podcast. The microwave is a very neglected tool in the kitchen, and you can use it, and it can make your life a lot easier.
I want to meet Gordon Ramsay for many reasons, right?
Oh, go on.
Right, but one of the big questions I want to ask him is, what has he got against microwaves?
Oh, that's total snobbery on his part, you know, because I've actually seen very good cooks and very good chefs mention the benefits of using the microwave.
Yeah, he always
see because it has certain particular traits that actually suit
things. Maybe it's okay for cooking, but not for heating up restaurant food.
I don't know. Anyway, these are crispy potato wedges. This is the kind of thing you could cook really quickly and have it like if you're watching a movie together with the family and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just think people really like it. And it's healthier than what you get in McDonald's. So basically, get your nice potatoes. You can see the potatoes there. I've just cut them into wedges, basically. And depending on the size of your wedges, that's going to depend with the amount of time in the oven. But the first thing that you're going to do, again, using the microwave, is I have that nice little container there. You see the container and put them into there. So you're going to pretty much cover them with water and put them into the microwave for about 10 minutes, basically. So you take them out. Next thing you want to do is you want to dry them. Dry them really, really well. And then when you've dried them really well, the next thing to do, and this is super important, don't miss out on doing this, you want to agitate them. Agitate, 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 agitate. Is that the right word? Agitate.
Mm.
Is there another word?
Yeah, adjective.
Shaky. Right, when they're dry, shaky. Make sure they're super dry.
Give them a fluffy edge.
This is going to become important, quite important. Meanwhile, by the way, I should have said it before, you want to heat that oven up to about 350, even 400. Why not? And put a nice thin layer of oil. Be awfully careful. This is a little bit dangerous. Don't let the children do this. Nice thin layer of oil in there, like an olive oil, like nice olive oil in there. Put that into the oven. Have that piping hot. And then gently put your potato wedges that have been dried and agitated, put them onto that baking sheet and put them in the oven and time it 10 minutes. 10 minutes one side, then turn them over 10 minutes the other side. And that's pretty much it. And look at how lovely they look. And then just put a little sprinkle of salt there. I just cut up some spring onions to bring a bit of colour to it. Mm-hmm. And they were yum, 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 yum. And yes, we ate them and watched the Oscars.
Could you salt the water when you boil them or not?
You could do that. If you really wanted to. But I didn't, and it didn't make a difference.
Okay.
But honestly... Right,
I can attest it did not make a difference. It's
they're really, really delicious. Nice. And I think they're going to be in heavy rotation around here. I love that. Heavy rotation. Heavy Do you rotation. Like that? So we're making the Hunter Biden movie. It's My Son Hunter. And you can help. And we are really close to some serious, important milestones that will allow us to start production.
Once we hit 700,000... We're now at something like $630,000, $640,000 raised. Once we hit 700, we can start hiring actors, start production... Start pre-production, starts
working out locations,
paying deposits for people, all those kind of things that are important and have to be done. So please give what you can. We really, really need to hit that 700,000 mark, and every bit helps. So please
do what you can. Thanks so much. See you next week.
See you next week. Bye.